Hello and welcome to Talking Capital. I'm Ian Barnard, CEO of CapGen. Each month, I'm joined by a member of our investment team or a guest from one of the investors in our universe to talk about the investment themes and opportunities that are available today to family investors. What is CapGen? We're a private investment office for families with capital. Our clients are sophisticated, internationally minded investors, and what we do is to help them make the most of their capital and to seek out investment opportunities across any asset class in any region of the world. So in the course of these episodes, you can expect us to cover a globally diversified portfolio of assets and sectors, be that bricks and mortar or derivatives. In summary then, this is a podcast where we discuss the questions that we think are playing on the minds of sophisticated long-term investors. If that sounds up your street, do please subscribe and you'll enjoy a new episode published on the first Thursday of each month. Welcome to Talking Capital. Today's interview is the second of our three-part series covering emerging market equities. Last month, as you'll recall, we spoke to our CIO, Robert Sears, about the broad positioning of emerging markets in portfolios. What is it that emerging market equities can do for portfolios and clients? And this month, we're going to look into greater detail with our research director at CapGen, Mario Acquistapace, who's going to talk about how he went from the broad opportunity down to an investable manager and product. So I'm going to turn over to Mario in a moment. But before, but in a slightly different way. Before we crack on with emerging markets, Mario, can you just give us a quick recap of your history at CapGen so listeners can have a sense of, you know, where you come from and how you fit into the team?
Sure. Let me say first, thank you, Ian, for having me on the podcast. Long time listener, first time caller here. I joined CapGen just over 9 years ago now. How that's flown by. But I started life here at CapGen in a different team, actually. It's like more client-focused team, and moved across to the investment research team probably around 7 years ago. And I've been sort of working my way through various through our various managers on the buy list and across asset classes. I've covered managers in the public equity space, in a couple of our hedge fund managers, and more recently, some of our private funds too. And so here we are today talking about one of those emerging markets managers.
I'm going to play the been around for a while card and just sort of contextualize, I think, how my experience of emerging markets in my career, which is they tend to work when the US isn't. And I can see that cycle going back to the EM boom of the early to mid 90s when the US was coming out of the savings and loan crisis. And then as the US gets going, sort of mid 90s onwards, President Clinton's repaying the national debt, you have this whole series of emerging market crises. Then we see emerging markets come back and they do particularly well in that aftermath of the financial crisis. And then middle of the 20-teens, as the US is taking up the reins again, they fall slightly backwards. And here we are again. And I suppose my question is whether that cycle repeats itself in that, you know, we've had a decade of underperformance from emerging markets. They've started doing well more recently at the same time as perhaps there have been one or two questions about the US. So that's my background and thoughts about it. But how would you describe, Mario, the reasons why emerging markets now rather than where they were, say, 5 years ago?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, look, they're certainly having a very good year, both on an absolute but also relative basis. So what do I mean by that? Well, you know, on an absolute basis, we've seen the MSCI Emerging Market Index, it's up, I think, around 28% year to date, which on its own is very good. But when we compare that with or versus the developed markets, you know, those returns look even better, as those are, you know, up, I think, in the region of 17% at the time of recording. But what exactly is driving those returns? And I think this is something you just touched on there, and you also spoke with Robert in the previous episode. But, you know, I think firstly, one of the most important drivers is this weaker dollar that we've been seeing, and that has historically supported emerging markets, and you know, it will ease debt burdens and improves trade competitiveness. And during this period as well, we've sort of, with that anticipation of rate cuts, it's not uncommon to see a general increase in capital flows sort of out of the US or other areas in developed markets towards emerging markets. think we've also seen some improved political stability across several key countries like Brazil, for example. Their equity market's up over 50% this year. And we've also seen a stronger than expected China recovery too, from obviously quite a low base. But that's been, it's obviously a huge component of the emerging markets index. And that's largely been driven by a rebound in consumer confidence, and that has seen domestic demand pick up. And this typically has a positive spillover effect into other emerging market economies, particularly those sort of close or regional trade partners and any commodity exporters too. And we shouldn't forget that there have also been some big winners in the AI space. We can't go have an episode talking about emerging markets without mentioning TSMC, the semiconductor manufacturer from Taiwan. It's one of the largest positive contributors to emerging markets performance this year. And I think it currently makes up over 10% of the index. So if you think about that, if you're an active emerging markets manager and you think this is a great business, you want to be overweight, that's an incredibly large position you need to have on in your portfolio. And then you have some of those other large constituents like the Chinese tech names, Tencent, Alibaba, they've all benefited from that sort of AI boom. And another key driver has been attractive valuations. So it's something we've spoken a lot at length here at Capgen. You know, the valuations look quite stretched in some areas of the equity market, particularly the US, but emerging markets from a valuation perspective look relatively much cheaper. And so for any long-term investor, that's a very attractive place to be, particularly when you consider those, or add in those demographic tailwinds as well. I suppose as it relates to portfolios, we have to decide whether we want to be active or passive in this space. And one area we looked at is equity dispersion. So that is, refers to the variation in returns across individual stocks within a particular equity market index. Or you can think about it as a measure of how differently stocks are behaving from one another. And unsurprisingly, this is much higher relatively in emerging markets versus developed ones.
So I'm going to butt in there, Mary, because I think that you touched on interesting subjects. So you mentioned Brazil there, that there was that old saw that, Brazil is tomorrow's country and always will be. And emerging markets are excitement and then can be often disappointment. And you can contrast, what's going on in Brazil with what's going on in Argentina. It's not to forecast the future, whether Milei with, US support will manage to keep turning things around or whether he will fall victim to this sort of volatility that seems to be endemic in Argentina. And they are a particularly sort of poor poster child for stability in EM. But I guess these are fragile economies and countries, not all of them necessarily. Is there fragility in China? Maybe there is, but it's clearly operating at a huge scale. And so when you're comparing, I see sort of enthusiasts for emerging markets sometimes getting a bit carried away, and people go from, okay, let's not just do emerging markets, let's do sort of EM small caps, for example, which I think is perhaps going too far. So that's the sort of positive. You've highlighted the reasons to be optimistic and positive, which we are. What are your sort of boundaries when you're thinking about emerging market equities? What are the things that you want to, if you like, screen out, risks that there are in emerging markets that you're consciously going to choose not to take or to try to tilt away from?
Sure. I've made it all sound very easy. But I guess, in reality, there are plenty of risks in emerging markets, and ranging from political instability to wars. And sometimes the hardest part for an active manager is actually just avoiding those big blow-ups or negative events. I mean, we don't have to cast our minds too far back in history to remember when Russian equities looked like an absolute bargain. At the end of 2021, they were considered an extremely undervalued investment, and by many that we spoke with. And then, of course, we saw them go from cheap to uninvestable almost overnight as Russia invaded Ukraine. And we saw the country sanctioned on various levels, and assets frozen and very much leaving investors stranded. So yes, I mean, the risks in emerging markets are very real, and they are, it's certainly more recently been a very challenging place to make money. I think it was one of the large consultants that published a piece of work I remember reading, showing how sort of it looked at the emerging market managers over a 5-year period and showed that almost a third of the managers that were in that top quartile over that 5-year period were then found in the bottom quartile in the preceding 5-year period. I think that just shows the sort of volatility and excess returns, and I guess evidence of that old saying that, you know, past performance is not a guarantee of future returns. And so it makes our job as fund selectors very difficult. But going back to what I was saying earlier, with sort of increased equity dispersion, and, you know, we also see much lower sell side analyst coverage from the large sort of research from the large investment banks. Naturally, this is true in sort of smaller mid-cap stocks. However, the trade-off is liquidity. Those stocks can be thinly traded in certain corners of the market. And this is, liquidity is something that we value, particularly in emerging markets. And in turn, we've tended to favor a strategy that focuses on larger cap stocks. And that can allow us, or rather the chosen manager, to be more dynamic with portfolio allocations and perhaps shifting that portfolio around according to the changes in sort of geopolitical landscape. And then I suppose there's the question of, do you want to go with a country-specific manager, or would you rather a sort of broader global emerging market strategy? So for example, we could select one India manager, one China manager, someone in LATAM, versus having one investment with a manager that will invest across global emerging market and that universe.
So I'm going to pause you there, Mario, because I do want us to now focus on the selection process. And I just want to sort of recap on something you said, which I think is quite important and worth bearing out. And I think you're saying, and I'm grossly oversimplifying, but humor me, there are sort of two arguments for emerging markets. There's a, if you like, a sort of cyclical one, which is that in aggregate, they generally tend to do better when interest rates are falling or lower, or the dollar's weaker or lower, and the two often correlate. And that's not always, but typically a sign that, for example, the US economy isn't doing terribly well, which, you know, might explain, for example, the, you know, past booms we've seen where US economy is having a tough time, interest rates fall in the US, the dollar weakens, and that's a tailwind for EM. And then when things turn around in the US, you see that reversal of fortune in emerging markets, which is the cyclical thing. But I think you're making the other point, which is almost regardless of that, you do have fundamentally inefficient markets. And there is, you know, wide dispersion, which, you know, is a technical word for saying it's a happy place for stock pickers. There's lots of inefficiency. And if you study companies, you can discover things that perhaps other people haven't discovered because there just aren't as many people doing it. So you've got this thing that isn't cyclical. It's more of a sort of secular observation. So that's if you like, the background on emerging markets. You began to talk about, Mario, sort of selection. Maybe we'll restart that now. And just, so there you are. We've identified this opportunity. What was then your next step? You talked about active versus passive, and then you talked about sort of country specific versus general. Can you just take us through your sort of hierarchy of selection, the sort of series of decisions that you take that gets you to a point where you've got one, two, three, or four chosen managers and products?
Sure. So yeah, so as you said, you know, we've identified this is a fertile environment for an active manager, and, you know, somewhere where we value liquidity, we value good risk management, and, you know, we think it's, or we place a high importance on local market knowledge. Going back to that debate around having a local sort of focused country specific manager versus a kind of global emerging markets manager. But maybe a good place to start is sort of idea generation. This sort of typically comes from two places. You know, the first, I suppose, is your classic top-down, whereby, you know, we make an asset allocation decision, and here it's, you know, let's say overweight emerging markets. Robert, the PM team, will come to us and say, we'd like you to find an emerging markets manager. We discuss any sort of particular parameters, such as the ones we've just mentioned, and then we go away and I guess we sort of begin to whittle down that universe of, let's say, 100 managers to just one or two names. And that's your classic top-down filter approach. And then, you know, we have what you sort of consider more of a bottom-up approach. And this is where, you know, maybe someone in the team has sort of followed a manager for a period of time, or, you know, sometimes it's even a client that introduces us to a manager, and we identify someone as excellent in their space, and we see their strategy as being a good fit in portfolios, or captures a particular opportunity set very well. And, you know, often we've been tracking them and following this manager for several years, and we've built up conviction over time. And, you know, there are instances actually when between that initial meeting and us investing client money, there's multiple years that pass. But, you know, the reality is that it's often this combination of the two. So we, you know, while we will start with a sort of large universe of managers, we typically have a clear idea of A, what it is we're looking for, and B, you know, we'll typically already have a good knowledge base of that market universe, manager universe, pardon. And, you know, one thing we do is lean heavily on our network. So be it across managers, investors like ourselves, you know, use the banks. We find it very useful to speak to people in all corners of the market, both for sourcing new ideas and investments, but also for referencing. It's something that plays a very important part of our due diligence process, be that speaking with existing investors, past investors, or people from other firms that might have worked or crossed paths with the individuals as the senior investment team of the manager that we're looking at. And here we're looking to sort of validate or unearth particular bits of information to sort of aid our decision. And I can think of an example quite recently, actually, where, you know, we're sort of halfway through our due diligence deep dive on a manager. So, you know, at this point, we've already committed significant time and resource. And after digging into some information we gathered from a particular reference, we ended up passing on the opportunity. That's not to say it was anything terrible, even though we do enjoy unearthing all manner of skeletons, but it was simply something we couldn't get comfortable with. And finally, one point I should mention, you know, and something I really value here at CapGen is, you know, we're relatively agnostic on type of manager. So things like size of firm, length of track record, we don't have to be so strict with, unlike many other investors. So we consider ourselves go anywhere investors. And if it's a manager that has just left a large firm to go it alone with a small team, we're not afraid to back them from day one. We've done it before. We go in with our eyes open. And, you know, while we value the small and hungry team, we also accept that the business risk may be higher. And sometimes if we truly think it's an exceptional individual team, we can get comfortable with that. But, you know, we're also equally happy to go with the large blue chip asset manager with vast resources, deep talent pool, and a ton of data that we can get stuck into. I guess in the end, it comes back to, you know, what do we think is the best approach for the specific opportunity set or market in front of us?
Right, that's super helpful. We're going to turn in a moment to, okay, having gone through all that process, what is the name that you came up with and why? But just before you do that, I just wanted to pick up on something you said, which I think, again, is quite important from a client perspective, I guess, which is this willingness to be agnostic, to walk away and to set a standard of excellence. And, you know, if you don't find something that meets that standard of excellence, then the answer is not to change the standard. The answer is to go and find something else to do. And I'll link that back to something that my fellow founding partner and obviously important client of the firm, Khalid, said years and years ago. And I remember him saying this, and it stuck in my mind. He said, "Look, the most exciting thing for me is not when we pick a manager, but when that manager's actually made some money for me." And we've tried to incorporate that in the firm by making sure that incentives, both financial, but also, I guess, sort of moral in a way, or in terms of how research team members feel, the most important thing is to maintain standards. There's no sense, is there, Mario, in which you have to sort of hit a certain number of, you know, if I don't do six managers this year, it's a bad year. Two really, really good managers is worth many, many more than six so-so ones.
No, absolutely. You know, I'm not judged on how many managers I churn out. And actually, you know, I found instances in the past where, you know, I've been applauded for turning down a manager, be it at the beginning of a search or actually near the end. We've, you know, collectively as a team, we've just decided there's not enough here. There's not enough evidence here for us to get comfortable with the particular risks that we see. So yeah, I think that's a really important aspect and something that, you know, I value and I think, you know, our clients should as well, because it's about, you know, independence of thought, and that's, yeah, it's important.
Good. So topic number three, after all that, who is it? So you have, you selected this a while ago now, because we've been investors for a while, you selected Carhe Capital and Aliake. Can you tell us a bit more about them as a firm? So what does it look like? What are the bits of emerging market risk that we've chosen to embrace in partnering with Ali, and sort of describe his firm before we come on to the to the rationale? What does Carhe look like?
Sure. So Carhe is first and foremost a sort of, you know, their flagship fund is actually a long equity short strategy, which runs a relatively low net exposure. This is more of what we'd expect a classic equity hedge fund to look like. So, you know, where the manager is taking both long positions in companies that they think will be winners and selling short the companies they think will be losers. But alongside this, the manager has another fund, which is what we describe as a long-only carve-out. So it's effectively contains just the long positions of that portfolio. And this is what we felt was a much better fit for our public equity portfolio, since, you know, we were not after just the alpha that we hoped the manager could generate, but also some of that emerging market beta as well.
Which, to link back, Mario, to what we were talking about, is the fact that you've got, well, we feel that there's this dual opportunity in emerging markets. There's a sort of writ large in aggregate emerging market opportunity, which is more of a cyclical one. And then you've got the stock picking, the positive stock picking environment, which is the sort of secular one. And you're saying the choice of a long only carve out from a hedge fund is you felt you were going to get the best of both of those sources of return.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, we've actually had a fair amount of success with these long only carve outs from hedge fund managers. You know, we hold the view that in some instances, having a manager that has a more flexible investment mandate versus the more traditional active equity fund, where they can trade the portfolio more dynamically, perhaps use a small amount of leverage at their discretion, and importantly, take outsized positions. You know, going back to what I said about TSMC being 10% of the index, that's particularly helpful today with the markets in some areas as concentrated as they are. We also feel the fee structure with these carve-outs can be more aligned. It typically involves paying an incentive fee over some sort of hurdle rather than an absolute performance.
Aligned but not low would be my comment. So, you know, we often have this debate about, you know, is it worth it? Because whilst they are lower, they're not low. How do you get comfortable with that? Because you're right, there are certainly benefits we see for going with these carve-outs, but they bring with them a sort of set of incentives that are different from your sort of more conventional long equity manager. How do you get comfortable with them?
No, I think it's a very good point, and it is somewhat of a trade-off. And you have to think about, is it worth paying more for that excess or potential excess return? I think, you know, what we found in many cases, because of the relatively higher fees that they can charge, they're also able to attract and retain some of the best talent. And, you know, in a world where you have, you know, some very large firms with very deep pockets, that can be quite important, sort of holding on to your best performing analysts. But to go back maybe to Carhe, I think, you know, we had met with them 3 years prior, and, you know, we'd been sort of monitoring them in the background, and, you know, we liked what they were doing. We liked this long only strategy, which we felt was a good fit in the portfolio, but also complemented our other emerging market equity exposure quite well. And we'd also used, you know, database to sort of compare the track record versus peers, and they consistently appeared in the top quartile. And this, you know, wasn't over a short space of time either. It was altogether, I think, a 15-year track record that we were looking at. You know, Aliake has what we would describe as great pedigree, as someone who's sort of honed his skill over the years and has somewhat fine-tuned his investment process through various iterations, and has very much been the product of his learnings at previous firms. And, you know, we always talk about the importance of experience and where these individuals have learned their craft. And in his case, it's, you know, several reputable firms. He's also surrounded by a team of on-the-ground specialist investment analysts. So, for example, he has an analyst on the ground in Brazil. He has one or two in India, two in China, and they're all feeding ideas and this local market information up to him. We found that also for an equity manager, he was what we describe as very macro aware. And he has this sort of risk-focused mindset and will often take very active country and sector positioning with sort of dynamic and, you know, at times quite concentrated position sizing. So that's something we also had to sort of dive into and get comfortable with. And, you know, the team will look to sort of identify, in some cases, specific catalysts and corporate events that they will then size up into. And he's able to do all of this by maintaining a relatively liquid portfolio. And going back to what we sort of mentioned earlier is, you know, this focus on large cap equities is sort of allows him to sort of do that. And I guess, you know, the outcome is this long only equity strategy with high tracking error, which is to say it can have a significant deviation from the emerging markets benchmark, but also high key person risk. And that was something that took us time to get comfortable with. And we spent a lot of time with Ali, and, you know, we think very highly of Ali's team and his deputy, but ultimately the secret sauce we believe is with him. And for this reason, we've had to size it accordingly within the client portfolios. And so far it's been a very successful partnership, and one that we, you know, I think we hope will continue for many more years. I think, Ian, you'll enjoy your conversation with him. He's, you know, he's a smart and passionate investor, first and foremost, but, you know, as well as a self-proclaimed history buff. So I'm sure the two of you will have plenty to talk about.
So just to recap on important decisions there. So this is it's an across the board EM manager. So it's not a single country. Large cap names rather than small cap. And that allows two things. It allows you to hold large position sizes and to hold large position sizes with reasonable scope for liquidity. So you can take high conviction positions, which I suppose is another point that you make, Mario, that what's attractive about this is you talk about tracking error, we can talk about sort of benchmark agnostic. He doesn't feel, or his team doesn't feel constrained by what the EM benchmark is doing. It's about sort of back to the conversation we were having about manager selection, is about picking the right stocks rather than having to buy particular stocks. On the ground expertise, so a team that is spread across the emerging markets. So whilst it's being run from London through a money centre, the eyes and ears that feed the ideas are broadly spread. Any other sort of key points we should bring out, Mario?
No, I think you hit all the main ones there. I think, you know, to add to that, I suppose, is, you know, they're willing to take these outsized positions at times, and that will often drive a lot of positive performance. As I mentioned, tracking error will be relatively greater than maybe some of the other managers we looked at. And I think, you know, we also benefit from the manager having, you know, one eye on their long short strategy. So, you know, the team are also looking at short opportunities, which I think just, you know, adds a different dimension to an equity analyst's sort of workflow. So all in all, we think it's a really sort of good all-round package.
Mary, thank you for that. Super helpful. Really enjoyed that. Appreciate you joining us. And as you say, in a month's time, I look forward to chatting to Ali and hearing the story from his point of view. So what it looks and feels like to be buying sterling stocks across the world in emerging markets. So Mary, thanks very much indeed. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
A link to Capgen's privacy notice and full terms can be found in this podcast summary description and on our website.